This is The Think Tank with Dr. Mike O'Neill, talking about the major political, economic, and social issues of the week. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com. The Think Tank.
Okay, very, very much in the public discussion these days. Immigrants, refugees. We have with us three people with unique perspective. Lisa Benson. She is a Middle East and foreign affairs expert. Jillian Lissay works internationally with a number of migrant issues in a number of countries. Jenny Deng is an actual one-time refugee, now a citizen of this country, but he has, for him, this issue is deeply personal because it's been him. All right. There is, the most dramatic issue of refugee and immigrant right now. There's a caravan in the southern part of Mexico. But Lisa, I want to start with you. I'm not sure everybody understands this. What is the difference between a migrant and a refugee?
Thanks for having me, Mike. Sure. A refugee is someone who is fleeing persecution for religious or political reasons. I think the Syrian refugees who fled out and left Aleppo and other places, they had no choice. They're repopulating someplace else because they can't be in their home centers. A migrant seeks a better life and usually seeking for economic conditions. And an asylum seeker is someone who is a refugee who is looking for a safe haven and going to a country to ask if they can come in and be safe so they're not hurt in their home.
Now, this is an area also where I think people misunderstand. Even a lot of folks who say, you know, quite rightly, you know, we have to follow the law. These folks have to follow the law. The law itself distinguishes what is required of us between migrants and refugees, does it not?
Yes. You know, asylum is the protection to foreign nationals. It is governed by international law according to the Immigration and Nationality Act. International law. It is U.S. law. U.S. law. Asylum can be sought either if you knock on the door of the country or if you're in another country and you're looking to leave, you can do it. The United States allows you to do that from another country as well. But it is for those who can't go back, who've had family members that were killed by militia or a governing body of their nation. And the countries that are right now in the caravan are those with horrific violence. Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador, and Central America.
And I think the distinction to make here, if I can sort of retranslate that, if you're in Mexico and you're not doing so well economically and you want to come to America to make a better life, you're a migrant and you don't have a right to enter this country.
Exactly.
If you are in Honduras and MI-13 says, your teenage son is going to join the gang or we will kill your entire family. That's, you have a pretty good case to be a refugee. And to those who say we must follow the law, American law says roughly, and I could get a lawyer to be very precise about mm-hmm. this, if you have a well-founded fear of persecution, that can be religious, that can be we're going to kill your whole family, then you have a right to seek refugee status in this country. And if you are denied entry and you have that legitimate claim on persecution, to deny you entry without a judicial determination is a violation of U.S. law.
You gave a mouthful.
Yeah.
Let's pick it apart one by one. First of all, this northern triangle of Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala is the deadliest. It is the deadliest zone in the world outside of conflict and war areas. So there are
Syria might be the only place close.
That's a war area, mm-hmm. absolutely. But for all the reasons that you just said. But what we're going to be up against is, well, first of all, we know the president is may make some executive orders to change existing law that's on the books. What had happened at the last migrant debacle where the children were taken away and they, some of them, 200 of them, may not even be with their parents yet, is that the United States military has been charged with setting up bases and military bases. So if this happened again, that there would be places for the families to go together. Well, guess what? This is now happening now, and it's not, the military bases are not ready to accommodate. Therefore, whatever is going to happen in the next couple of months with this migrant movement, and again, that is not an accurate, maybe not an accurate term, because we use the word migrant movement, which are people who are seeking a better life. But if they want to claim asylum and persecution, we need to start talking about them as refugees. And
I think the point of that is, it's probably not 100% of one or the other, and that's why I have a judiciary in this country to decide. We don't look at a picture from 1,000 miles away, and by the way, they're almost 2,000. They're not coming to Arizona, first of all. That's almost 2,000 miles by foot. I look at the map. If they're going to cross in the U.S., I know where. It's going to be Corpus Christi, because that's 1,000 miles away, which is the closest entry point. You know, if you're walking, you're not going 2,000 when you have a 1,000-mile option.
That is possible. And then there's, you know, the conspiracy theory, which I don't subscribe to. But if there is nefarious intent from individuals who are helping them, we don't know if they are going to spread out, you know, this way, that way. But that's neither here nor there. Let's not go there. Right now, what I'm hearing is that this will not grow, but it'll actually shrink. So it's shrinking. We know it's shrinking. But here's the one thing I want everybody to know. You have to know that the Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA, if we have reporters down there, we have CIA down there.
I can't believe that they don't. I mean, that's a fair point. If there's this crowd that says they're coming towards the U.S., we want to have somebody down there.
We know it.
To figure out who that is. And you know what? Those folks aren't talking.
That's right. And so the problem that I see having is that we have our commander-in-chief becomes hysterical, and then we all shut him off because we see everything through the lens of a political battle, and we're not listening.
Well, and of course, this was made most prominent in the period of 2 to 3 weeks before
an election.
An election that is a serious question. So, by the way, one thing before I have to break for this. Relevant to this and relevant to the issue of the law. Are you familiar with the Flores settlement?
Yes, I am.
You got a minute. Tell us what that is.
Well, the Flores settlement, I'm not an expert on it, but I will say that there is a lawsuit that has been filed against Donald Trump and the U.S. government for unconstitutional way that they're treating the caravan, and essentially it is based on the Flores,
which dates to 1997,
right? And I'm not an expert on it, but maybe someone else on our panel.
Well, I mean, I can read from a CNN report on that. 1997. There was a suit, and it went to federal court, and there was a settlement, and the government agreed to release children from immigration detention without unnecessary delay to their parents or other relatives, okay? It wasn't legal to separate parents from their children.
That's right.
That precedent was violated recently, and that was the club that was used to on the INS, it says, no. Put them back together, and as the judge said, basically said, do it now.
Yes.
We will be back in a minute. We will bring in to this discussion. We've been talking to Lisa Benson. We'll bring in Jalene Lussay and Jenny Deng when we return in just a moment in the Think Tank.
Awesome. Thank you.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We are talking in the Think Tank here with several people, one of whom is Jalene Lussay. The subject is refugees and migrants. And just to remind you, Jalene has worked internationally on migrant issues in, what did you say, 60 countries, I think it was?
Around there,
Big number. That's a lot of countries. One of the more interesting proposals in this whole debate is López Obrador, the incoming president of Mexico, soon to be inaugurated, has suggested that, you know, if we want to deal with this issue, what we need to do, and he proposed that this be a joint Canadian, U.S., and Mexican endeavor, what we have to do is to find a way to foster economic development in southern Mexico and Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador, the countries right down on that border, which, by the way, southern tip of Mexico, we're talking 1,000 miles from Corpus Christi, that in terms of this migrant. They're not on our doorstep. And if they ever get here, it's going to be a while. But economic development down there, because the southern Mexico is very poor, and you get into those other countries, you get into high violence situations. I wonder if you would address that and your own suggestions and
great,
observations.
Thanks. Well, you know, that actually is one of the standard UN practices. I mean, if you look at there's four indicators that the UN has put together that talks about any country that's at risk of instability. So one is rapid urban migration. And unlike the U.S., where our cities can actually handle migrants, in a lot of these cities in Mexico and in, you know, Honduras and El Salvador and Guatemala, their cities cannot handle urban migration. They don't have the jobs within the cities to support it. It creates slums. It creates then violence and crime and organized. And
slums there, we're talking cardboard shacks, not public housing.
Correct. We're talking no electricity, no running water, people on top of each other, really bad sanitation, and absolutely
an ecological disaster.
Ecological disaster.
Both in terms of the physical aspect and the social aspects.
Correct.
I'm hearing gangs and
everything,
the
right? Because that's where people turn. You know, there's no schools. I mean, it's people don't get to have a chance to go to school. So there's only really one option there. So again, that's the number one indicator for instability. The second one is rapid urban migration.
Mm-hmm. I mean, then the capacity to handle.
Correct. And then the second one is, you know, a competition for, you know, cropland and farming. And then the third is an explosion of the youth population. Anytime you have a rise, an unnatural rise in your youth population.
The second one was what?
Competition for grazing and farming.
Okay. Yeah.
And then the fourth is health concerns. In the past, it
third,
used to be HIV.
You missed it. You got health. Okay. I missed now the third.
Oh, sorry.
You're going a mile an hour. Okay.
I know. I always think that.
Let's recap. Four items.
Okay.
They are.
Number one, rapid urban migration. Yeah. Because the cities can't support it. Number two is a competition for grassland, cropland, farming.
Okay.
Number three is a rise in the youth population. When women do not have access to birth control, birth spacing, the ability to choose their families, right?
Yeah.
And then the fourth.
And that one's politically touchy here. Wow.
Just a little bit.
Okay. And number four?
And then number four, it used to be, and I don't know if this is still a strong indicator, but it used to be HIV. Mm-hmm. That for a long time in a lot of developing countries, HIV was very prevalent, and that kind of like ran over the top three.
Okay. But a mess, basically.
A mess. And so, you know, what the incoming president in Mexico is talking about is exactly what really needs to happen. If you want to prevent rapid urban migration, either to internal cities or to our country.
Sure, which makes sense. It's not that urbanization is bad. It's when it's beyond the capacity. You know, it's not unlike what I see what China's managing. They have, a billion people living in poverty in the rural areas, 400 million, more or less, American-style middle-class people. And everybody wants in the city, as any rational human being would, given those choices. And they're trying to, A, build the cities big enough, quickly enough to accommodate that, and B, constrain it so it doesn't overwhelm them.
Correct. And so investing in rural areas, right? Investing in these areas The issues there is that we need to invest in rural areas. We need to bring industry to rural areas. A lot of these rural areas also are very beautiful. And, you know, in Central America, you have a lot of jungles, you have a lot of resources. So you'll have conservationists saying, well, we can't exploit these areas. We don't want to take these, you know, resources away. So it becomes kind of touchy in a lot of these underdeveloped countries when people look at what the opportunity is versus what could be the cost. Mm-hmm. But the bottom line is if we want to prevent urban migration, if we want to prevent migrants coming here, people need to have jobs. But they also need to have jobs where they can also work safely. And so we have a complicated relationship with Mexico and Central America. You know, on one hand, migrants who come here, they send money home, which has become a huge part of the different economies, of these different countries' economies, right? So that's one level of it. And the second piece, though, to that is that, and in the past, that you know, the U.S. was a transit. Migrants would come here, they would work, they'd go back, they'd send monies. But now there's the violence, which is as Lisa was mentioning, that we don't know exactly how many are asylum seekers, how many people are really fleeing persecution and violence. We do know that Honduras is the murder capital of the world.
So there's reason to believe that a whole bunch of them have a reasonable fear of persecution, but nobody's going to accept that on a blanket basis.
Correct.
You're going to have to document that.
But where we know that there's viability there is, again, this comes back to our own country here. The U.S. is the number one drug consumption country in the world. And so we have this huge market because we are consumers. So it creates this huge, you know, need for drugs, which then creates a need for cartels and gangs and violence.
For whom I believe we also are the nearly sole supplier of weaponry.
And that's the other piece, is that gun smuggling, which is, again, a topic we don't talk about. Birth spacing and birth control. And we don't talk about guns in this country because nobody wants to give up their weapons. But what's
we're
happening...
We're not even here talking about taking guns from Americans. We're talking about cutting the flow of guns to cartels in the South.
Correct. And so drugs or gun smuggling. Every gun, I would put money. I don't know this for sure. I don't know this for sure, but I would put money on the fact that the guns that are being used by the cartels and the gangs in Central and just throughout Latin America all come from the U.S.
Because that's where, A, we're close enough, and B, that's where the guns are made.
We make them available.
Yeah. All right. We will return. We will discuss refugees, migrants. We're going to bring in Janie Deng, himself a one-time refugee, when we return after the break in the Think Tank.
Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Okay, we're back in the Think Tank talking refugees and immigrants. We've spoken with two experts, but they're American-born experts, Lisa Benson and Jalene Lassay. Unique perspective, Janie Deng was himself a refugee back, if I remember, 1998? Do I have that right?
1995.
From South Sudan, you came here from a camp in
Kenya, in northern Kenya.
Okay. And some of you may recall, he's been on the show once before, at least. He is what we referred to as the Lost Boys of Sudan, who were basically caught in this war-torn situation where awful numbers of family members were killed and the like, and ended up in a camp, came to the United States. The first question I want to address is based on what I have heard often from opponents of taking in either immigrants or refugees, and they say, oh, they want to come here because they get free food, they get free housing, they get free education, they get free medical care. All this stuff is coming to these folks at taxpayer expense. Tell us what you actually got, what people who came here actually got. These were people who were judged to be legitimate refugees rather than immigrants. I think immigrants probably get nothing. But we have Lisa address that later. But refugees, if anybody's going to get anything, is refugee. What aid did you get from the United States government, and for how long?
Yes, thank you, Mike. So when I first came, I was very fortunate to have a family that took me in, that sponsored.
Because you were a juvenile.
Because I was a juvenile. But I was very lucky because they kind of assigned me an age that they don't really know. So usually they assign us an age that sometimes we can be a little bit older or younger. We just, nobody have an idea. Mm-hmm. So I was very lucky. So to the point that I can able to get some help.
So you went to high school here.
Yes, exactly.
Where?
But that's not the case with other
In fact, most that came here were legal adults, right?
Right, exactly.
And that meant 18?
18.
If you're 18, talk to us. That's the more typical situation.
Yeah.
So
yes.
Kids get adopted by a family.
Right.
18-year-olds, what happens to them?
So 18-year-old, basically, you have about 3 months that they give you when the first day you get here. So the responsible social services will pay for your rent for basically 3 months. So meanwhile, on those 3 months, they training you to make sure you get a job. Inter-level job, it can be $5 per hour. So you go on with that, telling you save your money.
What kind of jobs do people typically
have? So the job is like dishwasher, thing like, you know, Walmart, you know, working in the airport, you know, running, you know.
I remember there being a lot of security guards.
Yes, and security guard, yeah. Exactly.
Because I think, if I recall, that ended up being desirable because those tended to be night jobs.
That's right. And the reason being is that was, but that later on, so they started getting into this job because they want to find out where they can go to school. So that was the biggest thing. So you get all of these guys just jump into the, you know, they're not. At this point, nothing given to them anymore. They start working like a, you know, getting American dream,
so
whatever
you call it. Basically 3 months rent.
Exactly. So they started looking for a job, looking for school while they're working three jobs, busting their butt off. It's nothing being given. And then on top of that, shortly after that, a year or so, you got to pay Uncle Sam back to your Robert G's airfare that they brought you in with.
So you got airfare here, but you had to pay it back.
That's right. So for everyone who's thinking, oh, you know, it's just a handover. There's no handover here. You got to, you know, first of all, you come to these places that are, you don't even know what language, you know, you don't know the language. You don't know the food you're going to eat. You don't know the culture. You don't speak to it. And here you are trying to live a life that you don't even know what's going to come next.
In
your new country.
In terms of not knowing anything, I remember seeing documentaries where a bunch of you guys are looking at this wall switch and trying to figure out what it is. And then there was the movie version they did was The Good Lie.
Right, exactly.
With the Reese Witherspoon. And right. There was a scene in there, and I assume it was but they're going to be picked up to be taken to a job by the social worker. And the phone rings, and nobody can.
And then they thought the phone was going to blow up like a bomb while the social worker is waiting for them. So those are the experience we had, you know, many of us had to go, get through when we get here.
And even had its moments of humor. One of my favorite ones was you're in this strange land, and this is one of the documents. You know where I'm going with this.
Yes.
This strange land, and everything is odd. And finally, somebody sees something that they see recognition, and it's a great big bottle of Pepsi. And the guy says, oh, we have this too in Sudan. We call it Coca-Cola.
Yeah.
So in tragedy, sometimes there's humor.
Absolutely. And we, and the point is here that talking about the immigrant and refugees, you know, I lived through that. I was one of those caravan. I walk to get to where I need to go. But
how far?
I know I was chasing.
How far did you walk?
You know, I walk probably over 2,000 miles or more, if it could be more. I remember.
Because you bounced around between.
Exactly.
From what countries did you go to?
So first we have to go to Ethiopia. Mm-hmm. After the civil war there, we had forced back out to southern Sudan. And then after that, we started walking toward Kenyan border. Mm-hmm. So literally for 6 months to a year, I was just wandering in the middle of jungle of Africa.
Were you were you with a group of any size at that point?
Yes. So we were most of us are young men, you know, young boys at that time.
I recall very often.
How old
were you?
Yeah, I was seven.
Seven.
So more than 5, 6, 7, 8 year old.
And no parent.
And no parent.
That's,
and no food.
And no food. That's mind-boggling.
Were you an asylum seeker?
Yes. Mm. So, and that's when I get to camp, to Robert G's camp in Kenya. Mm-hmm. So they finally, the U.S. government and the other government were there, and they, you know, we stay there for before we get discovered. And the only reason why we actually get discovered because, of course, you know, like any other government and stuff, so they have to go check the camera on to make sure we're not threat, because the threat was many of us, we're going to become, by this time, many of us are 10-year-old, 11-year-old, 14-year-old. Now we become teenager. So the U.S. was afraid to, if any bad guys at this time was Al-Shabaab was around this area, which is another terrorist group in East Africa. And they was afraid that they're going to recruit these young kids before they become 10, 18. We need to get them out here. And that's what the reason why our kids were actually
another story I remember you telling that was fascinating to me. You, in effect, you're in this refugee camp. You're actually running a business there, aren't you?
Yeah. Well, I have to not to just sit around because I'd be, you know, many of us, we just wait. We cannot just wait for UN to give you, you know.
So tell us what kind of, you're in a refugee camp. We think of this as a place where people just sit around and you wait for somebody to bring them lunch. What did you actually do to make money in the camps?
Yeah. So what I ended up doing is that the ration that were given to us, so we a little bit of that. So they get, when you leave the refugee camp, it's literally, it's not even a camping when you go out camping for a normal American. You know, you just go camping here.
This is not camping.
Yeah, it's not camping here. So they give you for 15 days, they give you about a 1 cup of maize or rice or oil, whatever the case might be. So that you have to get that to 15 days. So if you run out of that before then, well, you're out of luck because you're not going to have any food at all. So what I did was my ration was coming in, so I started tweeting it. So I go to the town, I go sell it with the money, and then I come back, and then I took a little bit of fun with the local currency there. Mm-hmm. Then I go and do the same thing with other, teaching these other kids do the same thing. So I go with a wholesale, I'd be carrying this little sugar or salt on my head, taken to the where that they don't have. So that's what I kind of did. Until
basically, classic micro entrepreneurial business.
That's right.
A lot of suggesting me a lot of personal savvy.
Right. Well, because you kind of just sit around. You're not gonna. Many people were starving at this point because food sometimes is not enough, or sometimes the truck would be. It's really hard. So the convoy that bring the food will get hijacked on the road by the bad guys. Sometimes we go month and month and month without food.
So one of the interesting observations about that is you're in this camp, but you're actually free to enter the town.
Yes. So you could do that illegal, not free as you just can go. They actually, you have to be very sneaky about it.
Okay.
And you have to make up some identity thing or pay your way around.
Okay. So basically you had to be especially savvy.
Yes.
Wow. By the way, last point I think I want to make. There's one thing that you guys always reported I thought was the most impressive thing at all. The way they folks in the camp who taught you about education.
Oh, yes. So that was a big pray for the Lord, especially for us, because many of us did not know who were alive, who was dead in our family for many years until like later on. Mm-hmm. So, but there's one thing we really focus, any other group, you know, probably any other group, probably, I don't know how we started this, but we know this is the only way we're going to be able to reconnect with whoever alive with our family member. So the education, we have a very important saying, is our mother and our father. So that was one of the things that was keeping our head going.
And the net result of that, somehow that got driven home.
That's right.
And the result in among the lost boys coming here under these most extreme situations, what percentage of them ended up in Phoenix, ended up with college degrees?
So about 85% of us.
So
80% either they have higher education, you know, they have a degree or a master's degree.
Wow. And you yourself have a master's degree,
yes,
right?
Yes,
okay.
Absolutely.
We will return with a group panel discussion in the think tank in just a moment, talking migrants and refugees.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Okay, we have been talking refugees and migrants with three of the most fascinating people I know. Lisa Benson, Jalene Lussay, Jenny Deng have all unique perspectives on this issue. I've asked them here to kind of, we've heard from each individually, kind of free for all, and my marching orders are at this point. You got something you're dying to say, make sure you work it into this discussion. We don't have to flow logically at this point, because I don't want anybody to walk out of here without having said their piece. Lisa.
Well, you know, I just want to point out that in the United States backyard, right in our backyard, there are terrorist groups originating from the Middle East who are increasingly cooperating with local criminal elements and drug cartels. And mostly we know that from South America. And we know that from Central America. We know Venezuela and Argentina. In 1992, 1994, there were bombings in Argentina. And that was clearly linked to Hezbollah. And one of the prosecutors, Alberto Nisman, he lost his life proving that. So we do have that element.
How do we ferret that out? Obviously, nobody wants that. So
you're going to ferret it out when they come, and if they put them in camps, and if they are actually vetted out properly, mm-hmm. that way we might be able to.
And I think.
But maybe Jalene might know.
No, nobody's against. Yeah, and you've worked with law enforcement agencies a lot, so.
Well, you know, and I know that's a concern. Yes, I do work a lot with international and local law enforcement, but that's not my. I always kind of hesitant around putting a lot of focus there because I think that's a very small part of like who's coming. Like if we talk about who's coming right now, this show is really about the caravan that's coming. What I would actually love to make sure that we think about as we close off this show today is what Jani was saying, right, is we have this perception, this stereotype, and it's being perpetuated every day in the news. Our president just had a really, really, really wrong ad, I feel, that was perpetuating fear of who, you know, who migrants are and who asylum seekers are. And we think of them as coming here to tax our system, to take away resources. But actually, they are incredibly people are really incredibly motivated for the American dream, for education, for being a contributing member of our society, to even be able, and if they're migrants, to be able to help their families back home, which means working really, really, really hard at several jobs to do that. And so I just.
And that's, we heard that firsthand from Jani. And Jani, of course, was a social worker with the Lost Boys Center. And so he's not just talking about his personal habits, but the what hundreds and hundreds of Lost Boys, all refugees that he worked with, what they went through.
Well, and let me just add one thing, because he also mentioned this, and this was great, right? Is I think that we need to be much more open, especially to younger people in these camps who could really use the future that we could provide. Because either we're going to bring them in and they're going to help better our companies and our corporations and with the education they receive, or they can be recruited by other elements because nobody wants to live their life in a camp. Nobody wants to stay in these conditions. So we can either help and mobilize and help people move forward, or we can risk losing a lot of people to these different terror groups and different things.
Number one complaint, if you are in the construction business in Phoenix or in agriculture almost anywhere in this country?
We have 10,000 open construction jobs in Arizona right now. In Utah, which is another place I spend a lot of time, there are $500 million worth of commercial projects happening because Amazon and Apple, I mean, everybody's moving to Utah. Nobody to do the jobs. So apprentices,
Say that again. We are not taking jobs from Americans because these jobs are going lacking at this
point.
There's
no one. I mean, actually, pay is really great. You can start as an apprentice who knows nothing at $30 to $45 an hour because there's nothing there, but there's not enough people to fill the jobs.
And
our government is suffering, by the way. There's not enough people to do construction jobs in our government to take care of our
Because all of the American citizens who want to do construction jobs have jobs. I think that would be the point.
Right.
Correct.
You know, there aren't too many people who sit. There are some. Those people already have jobs. People sit up and say, that's what I want to do.
Well, and those are laborers who do not have a salary. They make an hourly wage, which means they do not have health care, which means there's no incentive to do it because their bodies break.
I heard from Texas ranchers. I've had long conversations with Texas ranchers who are Republican. And they're saying, you know, hold the ship. You know, we need this labor down in Texas. So, I mean, that's just another, another way to – talking to the ranchers is an eye-opening experience.
I've heard the same thing with farmers in Alabama who are plowing under tomatoes because they didn't have anybody to pick them, and they are furious.
Yeah, you know, the fear, I think more – this is to go back to our political arena here. It's just to fear people, even though people are not just like that. You know, it's if you betted them right, like they did to me, they did to many of the Lost Boys and many other refugees. We actually were just not just getting in that camp and then we came over. It took 3 years for me even to even they able to put a flight together and all this. It takes 3 years to go through a very extreme vetting. And I know everyone out there always said, oh, they're not doing it enough. No.
Vetting, yeah.
Vetting. Mm-hmm. So for me, before I come, you know, so before I even foot touch in this country, mm-hmm. they have to go through a lot of background checks, all this. They could do the same thing.
Yeah. In other words, I think the image that we're just letting anybody in.
It's not true.
You know. But not true. I see, you know, I consider myself an independent voter, a moderate. I've spent a career in security issues in the Middle East and in the United States. So I view things through the lens of what are the threats and what are the reality. And I am still not confident that in any part of the world we can tell with 100% certainty that that we can identify somebody who has been MS-13 or it just doesn't happen. So what will happen in the next months, I think, will be the big great debate as we go into the 2020 cycle, because after this election, where this is what's going to happen. This is going to be a big debate in our country on immigration reform, and this topic is going to linger for quite some time on what is reform, who will steward the reform, will we work across party lines, not as we lead up to 2020.
Jalene.
So I mean, there's a couple of things I think we have to be careful. First of all, I'm actually not as nervous. I mean, I know how some of those investigations get done. So when people do go through the proper channels, as Jani said, it'd be really difficult to get through. It's a 2-year process, and our people are really good. They happen to be my clients.
Right.
They're really, really good at what they do.
Your clients include, I believe the FBI is one of them.
I trust what we have.
The other thing I'd say in terms of that, you know, I'm much more concerned in terms of coming into this country. If you're a well-funded terrorist organization, you can come here, fly first class, come in as a tourist.
But let me just say this. These caravans
really
have been coming since 2010 twice a year.
That's
and
right.
guess
okay,
what?
So this
They've
is
been
nothing
good
new.
People.
Okay. Last word is yours. Thank you very much.
Awesome.
Lisa
Thank
Benson,
you.
Jalene Lissay, Jani Dang. Terrific. I want you all back. We'll figure out some way to find new information on this. We will return next week in the Think Tank. By the way, you can get at KTIR.com. You can listen to this or any other podcast from 2018. Earlier ones are available at MikeO'Neill.org. We will see you next week in the Think Tank.